Today's guest once said, like any other life-sustaining resource, language can be depleted, polluted, contaminated, eroded, and filled with artificial stimulants. We'll find out what she meant in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's guest is Marilyn McIntyre, who is described as a dedicated list maker and award-winning author of books on language and faith. Having given up full-time teaching for more time writing, I am delighted, Marilyn, that you've been able to take time out of your schedule to join us today here on Mind Talk. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Marilyn, you have created what I would consider to be a thoughtful discourse on the breadth and the value of list making. And I have to say that when I first looked at the title, which is Make a List, I thought, well, people make lists all the time. What to buy at the grocery store, what you need to do today. And then I looked at the subtitle, which is how a simple practice can change our lives and open our hearts. And I became intrigued. So let's start with that. Let's start with how a simple practice such as list making can change our lives and open our hearts.
Well, I've been a list maker for a long time. And one of the things that seems to me always to happen when you begin to make a list of things you want, things that trouble you, ways to approach a problem, lists generate more lists for one thing. And once you start a list, there's no particular end to it. And so I find that as you begin to notice what you notice, more comes. And you take yourself by surprise. So lists seem to me to be ways of opening space for the spirit to move through you and for something to open up that you didn't plan. So for instance, when you begin to make a list of, say, ways to deal with a difficult relationship, let's say, and you put down the obvious things like chill out, take some time off, have a conversation in this or that way. But some new strategies will begin to come up and you notice yourself noticing them. So I think it's a way of tapping into a deeper place in your mind and your memory.
Notice what you notice. It sounds like we're talking about being intentional and mindful about the world around us.
Yes, and about the world within us.
Ah, good point. You heard me at the beginning of today's conversation share a quote from you, so I'm sure you recognize it, but it really is quite a stunning one. So just for a moment, I'm going to digress from making a list to the quote that you made in another book that you have written and ask you more about that. Like any other life-sustaining resource, language can be depleted. What do you mean by that?
I mean that as we listen to the discourse around us in the mass media and in ordinary conversation and the very scripted language we hear on television and import into our own lives, we probably all notice how words get overused, they turn into buzzwords, they get flattened, they get appropriated by certain partisan groups and therefore contaminated with ideologies we don't want to subscribe to, so they become kind of unusable. And I think we've all become used to hyperbole and generalities and abstractions that are evasions from a kind of specificity and truth-telling that we ought to be able to demand of those who are accountable to us. Specificity is a way of being accountable. But listen to most political discourse or commercial discourse. It's deliberately unspecific, hyperbolic, and, you know, filled with vapid adjectives to distract us from the fact that we're not really getting any information. That's an overstatement, but I think it's out there.
You know, it sounds like you really value words and what they can mean and what they can elicit in an individual. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, yeah. I really believe that language is one of the things that makes us distinctively human. Not that some animal groups don't have something linguists call language. But language is, in the biblical story, language is the power that's given to Adam to name the creatures of the earth and take dominion, which I don't think means, you know, exploit them. I do think it means make your home on the earth, look around, name the things around you, and care for them. And so, you know, we get that beautiful passage at the beginning of the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And there's a way in which utterance really lies at the heart of that story, that things were breathed and spoken into being. So I think that high understanding of language and its legacy is something we need to retrieve, because we squander it and we use it in ways that actually weaken it.
You know, as I'm listening to your thinking process about the value of words and language, I'm reminded of how often things are said to children that are enormously powerful, how often things are said from one adult to another, enormously powerful. And perhaps because we can't necessarily see the word, but we certainly can see the impact of the words, we don't pay as much attention as we need to.
Right. Right. Well, words stay with people.
Right.
I've often asked classes to just think of a line from a poem or a hymn or a phrase even that stays with you, and consider how you carry it, how it comes back when you need it. It's one reason memorizing poetry used to be such a commonplace in school curricula. It isn't anymore. But what you learn by heart stays in your heart. It's available for the life moments when you need it.
True indeed. When you talk about making a list, again, as I said a few moments ago, for many people, the knee-jerk reaction to that is, let me grab my phone, let me type in a couple of letters which will let me know they mean a word, but I'm not going to type the whole word because who's got time? That's not
yes.
The kind of list making you're talking about.
No, I think that those things have their place, and there, of course, is a practical value too. So I don't want to just be a Luddite and dismiss the value of the devices that we have at our disposal. But I do think that texting, for instance, even further loosens our connection to the deep histories of words, the etymologies, the way words carry in them and in their spelling a reflection of a long history and the evolution of that word itself. There's a residue of that in the word. In writing the word, there's a brain-to-hand connection. So when you write a word, you craft something, you pause over it. And the more we abbreviate that process, the more I think we affect ourselves neurologically. We kind of reduce collective memory and personal memory of what we speak with and what it means to say what we say. I think what do you mean is a really powerful question, and we need to ask more often, because I think it's easy to fall into saying things that you only half mean or have half thought about. What you mean is a question that keeps people accountable.
And it also keeps the listener from going off in a direction that was not at all intended, or perhaps intended, but at least with clarity.
Yes. Clarity is a gift. I'm always so grateful for people's clarity, even if they're saying something hard. You at least know what you have to deal with.
That's an interesting perspective, that clarity is a gift. And as I consider even what you've just said, it makes more sense than perhaps we might ordinarily think of. As you've said, so many times when we get clarification about something, we either like it or we don't like it, and depending on whether we like it or not will often determine whether we take it in or not, and we will ignore sometimes all that it actually means, all that it actually mm-hmm. tells us.
Right.
You've said right. that you, every time you make a list, you learn something. So I want you to walk us through the process of a list that you have created for yourself that resulted in new learning.
Okay. Let's see. I've written a lot of lists.
Indeed.
And some of them I've written for my own purposes. I made a little series of postcards at one time that were all lists just for fun. One of them was what marriage teaches. And it was, I think I probably did it around the time of an anniversary, so I may have done it as a gift to my husband, but really became a reflection on marriage that was very helpful to me. And I have the book here, so let me just find it.
I was going to say, it is in the book, so folks can look it up. I also noticed what weddings require, which was also a very interesting list. But share with
yes.
us, share with us marriage.
I can do the weddings one if you want.
Let's talk about the marriage.
Okay. Well, so this list was called What Marriage Teaches. And I just started, you know, once you have a title, it gives you some energy. It opens a space for the imagination. And so where it starts is there's more than one way. What goes without saying doesn't, which that was fun to put down because, you know, a lot of things, especially when you first start out in a marriage, you take things for granted that were part of your own family culture. And then you realize this wasn't at all part of your partner's family culture, and what you are assuming doesn't go without saying. So what goes without saying doesn't. There are no isms in intimacy. You can't just lean on your ideology and expect that to shore you up. You have to talk about it. Love requires imagination. Laughter heals. Taboos are toxic. A hug provides more energy than a vitamin pill. Apologize is an active verb. And so on. It's a kind of a long list. But as I came up with them, as you might hear in what I've read so far, it was not only that I came up with thoughts or memories or sudden insights about my own experience of marriage, but it was partly a process of coming up with fun ways to put it down. And so the relationship of list making to the practice of poetry has seemed very close to me at times. Sometimes you write a list and it wants to be a poem and you kind of move lines around and it starts to act like a poem. And a few times I've published a list and somebody said, oh, I really liked your poem. And I think, wasn't a poem. It was a list. But they're really close. And a lot of poems are lists. Like, how do I love thee? Let me count the ways. You know, many poets resort to lists as a structure of a poem.
It's very true. You say that lists are mirrors. Say more about that.
Yes. Well, to use the marriage list as an example, the further I went in making what is a much longer list than what I read, the more I invited myself into reflection about marriage, and the more I recognized about my own experience of marriage, my gratitude for the particulars of the rituals of life that we've developed together, the more I found ways to put down some specifics about how we get through the hard spots and about what comes up. So in that sense, as you write, you mirror something back to yourself. You begin to recognize what's coming forth. And so just making a space for it, giving it a little time, saying, oh yeah, there's more, I'm not done yet. That opens something up. And when I've done this with classes, when I've said, let's make a list of, this is one I've done often, let's make a list of verbs for things light does. And we start with light shines, light illumines, light, enlightens, light burns. And then people begin to, as you say all the obvious things, then people begin to say things that are less obvious, like light bends and it oozes and it seeps and it dances. And so the verbs become much livelier as imagination gets triggered. But you have to get through the obvious stuff first.
It sounds like even in, as you describe that list that you worked with your students on, there's a particular connectedness to the self, to the language, to the world in which that individual who's creating the list experiences their life. Again, you know, just the simple concept of make a list is so much more broad and powerful than I think we typically give lists credit for.
Yeah, I think so too. And even a grocery list can be a mirror. Just, you know, what do we eat? What do we buy? Every once in a while, if you take a step back and look at your own grocery list, you have a sense of a pattern of life. Once in a while, don't you go to the grocery store and notice something you've never bothered to even try because it's not on the list you always make?
So, in fact, this whole idea, you know, it's interesting. It's such a simple word, a list. It's a good four-letter word. And it can open up something so much more broad than we typically acknowledge within ourselves. It's really... As I was reading Make a List, I thought it's a fascinating read. It's a very thoughtful read on how to experience yourself and to be more aware of yourself in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes it can go pretty deep. Like, what do I want now? Can get you to a place of really reflecting on what is this season of life and what are the things I no longer want and what are the things I want at a deeper level. Or if you just make a list of things I really believe, you know, it becomes a little credo. It doesn't have to be long paragraphs of theologizing about your life, but what do I really believe about family life, about public process, about God, about children. And so those can go to some depth, but they're also lighthearted lists that can be kind of fun. I wrote one called A Manifesto for Moving Day, which was just things to recognize about what's happening when you try to pack up and move. And that one had very practical value when you're trying to sort through your stuff, like if you haven't used it for the last year, maybe you don't need it. But it's a little record of a conversation one has with oneself at particular moments.
I think there's...
And then I did one time, I do them for occasions, and I did one time for Mother's Day called Other Mothers. Some of the items on that one were the woman who taught you to read, the babysitter who played with you instead of watching TV, the woman next door who came to your piano recitals, the boyfriend's mom who still liked you after you broke up, the old woman at church who prayed for you, and so on. That one goes on too. But I just found myself feeling more and more grateful for the women in my life, the elders that I thought of as other mothers.
Meryl,
so that one gets circulated every year.
Marilyn McIntyre, author of Make a List, How a Simple Practice Can Change Our Lives and Open Our Hearts. We're going to take a break, and we will be right back. Marilyn, I want to go back to your manifesto for moving day. You know, it occurs to me that so many of your lists actually would make wonderful, useful cards that people could frame and hold on to for much of a lifetime.
Yeah.
But on a manifesto for moving day, there were a couple that really jumped out at me, and I think will jump out at a lot of people. For example, the Velveteen Rabbit will not become real.
Yes.
Or bits
it's
of...
It's sad, but true.
It is sad, but it is very true. So maybe you can rethink how you are holding on to that. Or perhaps one of my favorite ones, bits of unidentifiable hardware are not potentially useful. How many people fall into that trap?
Well, I do.
Or you, other people's stuff is easier to sort. That is very true. And sometimes it's better not to supervise. One of the things that I enjoy about all the lists that you've created and that you recommend that we create for ourselves, there's a lot of thought in them, but there's also a great deal of practicality in them.
Yeah, I think one of the fun things about what comes up as you're making a list is that it comes up from different levels of awareness. And a single list can contain things that are quite serious and worth further reflection and come from a place of depth. And other things can be really lighthearted and funny and just fun to put down. And so I think it gives you a sense of the variegated way in which your consciousness works.
One of the lists, as I said, in addition to sharing your own lists with the audience, you also give several lists of things that people might like to try for themselves. And one of the lists that you suggest, which I thought was really very important, perhaps particularly in today's world, but perhaps particularly for always, is a list of undue pressures on young people you love. So many times, as you know, parents forget that young people are either not full-fledged adults or two-year-olds. Talk about your thought in suggesting that particular list. What were you hoping people would get from that?
I think that it's really easy, especially with the people we live with or live near and love, to just kind of pigeonhole them. And also to reduce our perceptions to, oh, they're acting out again. Or, you know, she must just be tired. But to really name what are the pressures this person is under is to pause long enough to recognize that all of us lead very complex lives, including children. And especially now, kids are under lots of stress. So much, they're navigating an electronic jungle that's unprecedented in its complexity. And there are dangers in the world that they have to be aware of with all their, you know, gun drills in school. And so kids are carrying a level of anxiety and a level of complexity and a level of pressure to get into college or to make the team that I think are peculiar to their generation. I remember a conversation with one of my daughters some time ago when I started a sentence, well, when I was your age, and she very sweetly, without being snarky about it, said, Mom, it's not the way it was when you were my age. And it was just a gentle reminder that the world she is navigating is really different. So it was helpful to me at one point to just sit and think about the particular pressures the girls faced when they walked out the door in the morning and went to school.
And as you
I think
gave,
it helped me be a better mom.
As you gave that idea some thought, what were some of the things that you noticed that perhaps you hadn't been aware of prior to really intentionally thinking about it?
I think I became more deeply aware of how my daughters at the time were subject to a male gaze at school that made them really self-conscious, that how they were concerned about weight gain and loss, how they were concerned about what to wear and what kind of range of choice they had about how to present themselves. I think they were concerned about how to study in an environment when in a public school, when there were so many things competing with studying and facing trade-offs every single day that I didn't really pause to think about enough until I paused to think about it. But they were having to make some fairly adult decisions about how to expend their own time and energies and money and attention that in some ways were pretty subtle and in other ways could be really devastating. They had to decide what to talk to their parents about, which all kids do. What do you keep secret and process within yourself? And what do you share with your family? So none of this stuff, I think, can be taken for granted anymore. We don't live in a culture where the rules are clear for every family. We don't all know what to do.
As you became more aware of experiences that your daughters were potentially having, you said it has the potential for making you a better parent. How so?
Well, I think noticing each other is a dimension of love that we can't afford to short circuit. And it's really easy not to notice the people that you see every day. So, you know, just as a practice of noticing, list making can be helpful. You know, a sweet thing to do for a kid on a birthday is just to make a list on the birthday card of things I notice about you now, things I've noticed about you in the last 6 months. We all want to be seen, and we all want to be seen in a way that takes fully into account our evolution and our development and what's blossoming and what's emerging. But those are subtle things, and they happen gradually, and it's really easy to overlook them and think that we're looking at the same kid that was standing in front of us a year ago.
So
the lists help tease that out.
We all want to know that we matter, and as you talk about the practice of just creating lists for in a birthday card or just sort of randomly and sharing it with the individual, it again lets that person know that they matter to you and that you value them.
Yeah. I've put quite a few lists on birthday cards and anniversary cards. It's been a fun way to communicate with people. And as I said, it's non-threatening. You don't have to write a long manifesto about how you value them. Putting down a list is surprising and fun for people.
You talk about, again, in looking at some of the lists that you recommend, and there are many that you recommend in Make a List. One of them is irrational fears. I would think that might be a challenge for someone. Typically, what somebody else might see as irrational fears are not irrational fears for us. They have some basis. So how would one approach a list like that?
Well, I told someone the other day about writing down a list of things I'm afraid of. And she sort of recoiled, like, why would you do that? That's so dark. And it's kind of gets overwhelming, and it can, but my experience has been that when I really articulate what are the fears that I carry, some of them are huge, of course, the consequences of climate change or nuclear war, you know, the kind of thing that we live with in our historical moment, or the fears about the grandchild who's now learning to drive. But when I name them, two things can happen. One is that they can seem not quite so overwhelming because there are a lot of people working on them. And it can help me to become aware of how many people in the world are quietly looking for solutions and where I can plug into all the great organizations that are addressing the problems that scare me. And Secondly, I think to put the fear down is the beginning of externalizing it and saying, okay, there it is. How do I handle it? And beginning to reflect on strategies for coping with fear. You know, sharing your fears with someone else is always a way of beginning to be not afraid.
And I think also in sharing with other people, very often you discover that you're not alone in your thought or your feeling or your concern.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't think hiding from fears makes us less afraid. I think it makes us more afraid.
You talk about chronic choice overload.
Yes.
Isn't the ability to make a choice a good thing?
Well, it may be, but I remember walking through an American grocery store with a person who'd come from another country and just watching first the kind of bedazzlement at all of the choices and then a sort of overwhelm of choices. And I think that we do overwhelm ourselves with choice and variety more than any other culture in the world. And what I'm aware of personally, and I've talked with other people about this, is that there is a certain place of expending way too much energy making small choices. I don't know if this is true, but I heard somewhere that President Obama had like X number of blue suits and ties, and he didn't want to have to think about his clothes every morning. He just had a small range of things to choose from, and he put them on, and he went on with his day. And there are days when I think, why don't we all just wear uniforms? It would be easier. So I don't really want to wear a uniform, but I understand that sometimes having so many choices in any given store you walk into or when you look in your closet or all of the what we call freedom can have a kind of promiscuity to it, where we're really just expending our energies in too many different directions. So it's good to be aware of what choices we might like to limit.
One of the lists that you suggest, which again is a timely one in today's world, but perhaps a dicey one as well, is what might be discovered between right wing and left wing. What was on your mind as you created that thought?
Well, it seems fairly clear that we are in a culture and a moment when polarization has become pretty extreme between what we call the right and the left. Politically, theologically, culturally, we are so divided, we meaning North Americans, and very much at odds with each other over certain key issues that have become so fraught, it's difficult to find a middle ground. But the middle ground is really where we live. I wrote a piece one time called The Gray Area is Holy Ground. Because I think that what if we are going to work out our differences, we have to not just find sort of compromise in the sense of giving way, but creative compromise that says, what could we all live with that would enable us to live more compatibly? How can we find a way not to just be at odds with each other? But one of the things that's happened, going back to language, is that language has self-absorbed so much partisan energy. Words have sort of fields of energy that it's hard to even find words that aren't loaded. So if you, I'm trying to think of a good example of this. If you use a word like gun control, people are going to hear that very differently depending on how they feel about background checks or about the sale of weapons or about the Second Amendment. Even if you use the phrase Second Amendment, that's a trigger now because everybody is so hyper aware. But it's a trigger for people both on the right and the left, and they get entrenched in their positions, and then it's hard to have the conversation. So unpacking those things and saying, wait, what do we mean when we talk about the Second Amendment? What might the founding fathers have meant? What kind of weapons are we talking about? And just pausing and getting beyond the barrier of a term that has become a blinder takes some deliberation, and that's where I think the list making can help.
How does one go about determining what lists to create?
Oh, you know, once you start the practice, they keep suggesting themselves. One of the things that's fun is word lists, you know, like the things light does. But what action looks like, what love looks like, what enjoyment looks like, or anything, you know, things I like in my house. Things I don't want to get rid of, things to let go of. One time at a women's retreat, I suggested that they do a list of things to let go of, and immediately a woman in the third row said, "I don't want to do that one." I thought, okay, I bet there are some things you actually need to let go of.
Exactly.
But lists can come up anytime, you know, things I am done with. So if you just start to put down the word things to listen to, I have one list just called listen. We used to go, when the girls were little, we would take them on walks that were just sound walks or smell walks. So what are some things you hear, things to listen for? And on that list, I remember one thing was the hum of insects or the voices in the morning, or the listen for the word you need, or listen to the waves, or listen to Bach. But that just starts a little thread of awareness about how listening carries you through the day and how what you hear becomes part of your environment, and you internalize that rhythms of your life from the way you listen consciously and unconsciously.
Do you remember when you first became aware of the power of lists in your own life?
Oh, I think that as a child, I think I took a certain pleasure in writing things down. Just writing things down was fun for me. I was in a family, and I recognize now that it was a great gift. But a three-generation family, we lived with my grandparents in our household, who all loved conversation. Two of them were teachers. My father dealt in antiquarian used books, and he read all the time. And so people had fun with words, and people would tease things out in conversation that you hadn't thought of before. So I think that was a wonderful, fertile ground for reflection of the kind we're talking about. Just pointing out words. I remember this sweet, funny, humorous way my grandmother would correct me if I had spoken badly. And she'd say, "Try that again." And I would try it again. So I think just noticing words was the beginning of it. And then I also think often about, I think it was Auden, maybe E.M. Forster, who said, "How can I know what I think till I see what I say?" And that experience of writing something down and going, "Oh, yeah, huh." That's a really common experience. So sometimes I just think writing itself generates awareness and thought that you wouldn't have if you didn't write.
Do you recommend that individuals write by hand, or does it matter?
I think it matters. I do a lot of my writing these days on the computer for the reason most of us do, which is that it's faster and you can store things more easily. So I'm certainly not anti-technology in that sense, but I am also aware of the value of handwriting. As I said, there's a real neurological effect to crafting a word with your hand on paper. It connects your brain to your body, to the paper, in a way that puts you in possession of words that we can't afford to lose. We went to a calligraphy conference, a wonderful international gathering of people who do beautiful work in calligraphy. And they had a discussion one evening about the talking points or the arguments for continuing to teach cursive writing in schools, because many schools don't. And my college students, over the past 15 years, many of them have come in unable really to write cursive because they never really got taught. So making the letters and connecting the letters and seeing how the letters are related to one another and how words are related to one another begins to atrophy if you don't make words with your hand.
Marilyn, I'm going to interrupt you. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'd like to pick up right here because this is a conversation that I think is an important one to continue. Folks, stay where you are. We'll be right back. The art of writing in cursive, it's something, as you've said, that seems so lost in our society. Can you speak more to your thoughts about that, just about the practice of learning how to write by hand?
Well, writing by hand is an art form. You're crafting letters, and many of us grew up with the Palmer method in North America. It's an American method, but the slightly angled letters and so on. But then all of us stylized our writing as we go along. And I took a course one time in handwriting analysis that was fascinating. They actually used it. I don't know if they still do, but at the time, she said it's commonly used in criminology and sometimes in diagnostics. What you do when you craft a letter is you make an inscription on time and in time and space. And your letters say something about how you are externalizing your sense of presence in time and space. It's really a fascinating field of study, how people bring self to word. And also I think about just beauty, putting a beautiful thing in the world. Asking why write by hand is a little like asking why would anybody draw or paint. There's something about recording what we see and experience that can't be reduced simply to practicality. But I think people used to speak about she has a beautiful hand, meaning her handwriting is beautiful. And I love the metonymy of that, to call it a beautiful hand. Just the beauty of beautiful handwriting is a very human pleasure.
What is your sense of the way schools are now thinking about writing, particularly cursive writing?
I think that schools are under enormous pressure to accomplish a great deal more in terms of breadth of curriculum than they once had to. They're trying to introduce kids to computer skills early in elementary school. And they're trying to give kids a sense of how to grow up into a very complicated technological world. Children who are already fairly competent at technology by the time they're 8 or 10. And they're trying to equip children to make choices that I don't think, you know, 6, 7, 8-year-olds should have to make. They're trying to teach kids about the food systems they inhabit and about the soil, the water, the world, to help them think in a planetary way. And so gradually things that seem to be less urgent get crowded out of the curriculum. And that's why fine arts programs are really being marginalized. But because it's harder to argue for the necessity of an art class or a music class or a course devoted to handwriting. But the utilitarian approach to these things is really going to hurt us ultimately, because beauty and care and kind of aesthetic awareness is something I don't believe we can afford to give up. If we do, our relationship to one another is going to be severely reduced. And I think that that lays the groundwork for tyranny and cruelty and the kinds of things we've seen when other cultures degenerate.
And as you talk about the value of creativity, of art, of being mindful and thoughtful about your words and your goals, you actually make an urgent plea to include those in our curriculum in school as well as out of school, in our learning curriculum as well as our personal curriculum.
Yeah.
Because you're right, the more we get away from an awareness and of the fullness, I think, of our lives and what's around us, the easier it is for us to create isms and see things in black and white, literally and effectively. And it really does allow us to become smaller people, I would suggest.
I think so. I think it's easy to become reductive and simplistic if life consists mostly of shortcuts and shorthand.
You said in Make a List that you've always been slightly annoyed when someone solemnly insists in the name of broad-mindedness that there are two sides to every story. Say more about that.
Well, that's because I think there are at least 360 sides to every story, and the two sides to every question maxim is what leads to the kind of polarization we were talking about, right? Right or left, up or down, north or south, Republican or Democrat. And the either or approach to things really means that you lose subtlety, you lose nuance, you lose this sense of paradox, the ways that things that seem to be opposites may also be interdependent. And so of the ways we may need the people in our lives who are oppositional in order to keep asking ourselves important questions. But I remember a line, I've loved teaching Moby Dick for many years, and one of the lines in it that I most come back to is where Ishmael says, "Don't expand your mind, subtleize it." Subtleize isn't a very graceful word, but really, instead of looking out for more and more things to pay attention to, look at the things you're already looking at and move in rather than moving on. Ask some more questions about them. Stay with them, which really is what a list is. It's a way of staying with. I'm going to stay with this. I'm going to stay with this a little longer and see what I see.
You offer an exercise that takes you from the recitation of facts, a listing of facts, to the implication of facts. And in both instances, I'm putting facts in quotes. Why is that important?
Why is it important?
Yes.
Well, I think it's really easy to think of a fact as a kind of inert object. It is what it is, so to speak. But every fact has implications. I mean, even if you say the table is standing there, there are all of a sudden six questions you can ask about the table: who, what, when, where, how, and why. Why is it standing there? What's the, you know, why did, who put it there? What is it designed for? What does it actually get used for because it's sitting there? You know, so the simplest facts can open up avenues of reflection that might actually turn out to be important if you just bring questions to the facts. That habit of asking the next question is, I think, the difference between being thoughtful and being thoughtless or superficial. And there's always a question to
It sounds like you really want people to be more aware of what's right in front of them, which we, quite frankly, very often are not.
Well, and I think there's a reason we're not. I think we live in a culture of products rather than process, in the sense that we are sold products without being given the stories of the process. And in fact, processes are often deliberately hidden if they involve sweatshops or, toxic waste or something. So, to say, wait a minute, where did this come from? Who made it? Who farmed it? Who marketed it? How much petroleum was involved? How many pesticides were involved? How many people's lives were involved? What were they getting paid? Just to follow the process by which anything comes to be in front of us is to be a more active participant in those processes, and maybe to become somebody who shows up at a city council meeting or a board meeting. I don't think we can afford to lose that sense of the process that everything we see has a story.
It sounds like in the creation of any number of lists, you're asking folks, again, to be more present about the wonders of the world in which we live. And wonders don't have to be seen as positive or negative, but just the wondrous complexity of this world we call our life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just if you made a list of things I'd like to know more about, things in my house that I'd like to understand better, like how the fireplace, how the chimney works, or how the plumbing works or something, just to be aware of just in our immediate environment how much thought and design has gone into making our lives work the way they work. That's exhilarating. And it keeps you at a learning edge. I think it's really important to be a lifelong learner.
Now, there are people, as you know, who will write a list and then forget where they put it and certainly forget what's on the list.
Have to say, I do that too. I
Okay.
just will admit that I write grocery lists and then I leave them on the kitchen counter and then wander the aisles of the grocery store along with everybody else. But somehow, having written the list is helpful. It does kind of stay in the memory. I'm not proud of this. It would be good to take the list to the store.
Yes, particularly if
But
that
I
was
do
what you
think
wrote it for.
that lists, yeah. But lists kind of help you stay clear about your intentions so you don't just sort of wander off in time and space. There's something good about the impressionistic shopping trip, but I think it's helpful to have a list. So part of what they do is keep you on track. And if you do want your life to work efficiently enough so that you can spend some free time doing the things you love, then list making helps you be efficient about the things that you don't so much love, but you have to do them.
What do you mean when you say enjoy complete permission? What are you talking about?
Enjoy complete what?
Permission.
Oh, permission. A list is when once you start doing that, you give yourself permission to write everything down. And a list is a space where you can claim some permission to sort of go anywhere because it isn't an outline. There's no formula. You don't have to create a story arc. So you can just include everything, anything that comes up. And that itself is a kind of pleasure that I'm not going to edit. I'm not going to organize. I'm not going to do all the things my English teacher told me to do in a paper because it's just a list. But then what's just a list, as we've said in many ways, turns out to be much more. At least it's really rich soil for further reflection. And sometimes you look at a list and think, oh, I want to write more about that. If you're inclined to write, and I'm a writer, and so a lot of what I write comes from having made a list and then noticed a thing on the list that I really wanted to write a piece about.
Is there, for those listening, there's probably one or two people in the world who don't write lists routinely, maybe even more than that. Is there a way for them to start with the openness that you describe in your book?
Well, I think one very non-threatening way to try this out is to give yourself an arbitrary number, like 3 things I like about, or 5 things I've noticed about, or 7 things I wonder about, or, 10 things I want, 10 places I'd like to go. But just play around with giving yourself very short lists, slightly longer lists, and see what happens. If you sort of create that space, it becomes your tennis court where you can now play the game. And knowing that it doesn't have to be very long, knowing that this is a short process, knowing that it's a process of just seeing what happens and finding out, makes it all very experimental and playful. And really, all of this is a form of play. Even the stuff that comes to a pretty deep place of fears or anxieties or long-term plans can start with a really playful process. I'm going to let something happen.
Do you recommend that one write a list alone or with a partner?
Oh, both can be really fun. It's really fun to do this together in a group of people. And I've done quite a bit of list making with classes, and I do retreats and workshops with people all over the country. And it's so much fun to get people together and a big white sheet of paper and say, okay, so let's make a list of things I hope for from the weekend, things I hope for from this weekend together, or things I really don't want to talk about, or words that trouble me, or whatever it is. But you put something out there, and then people begin to add to it, and that's a very synergistic process. As soon as one person says something, something occurs to someone else. So I think doing it in a group is very valuable. Doing it alone takes you inside. I'm an introvert. I like hanging out inside. But some people might find that list making is really much more fun if they do it with a partner or a group of friends.
Marilyn, how does the listener get more information about the work that you're doing?
I have a website. It's just marilynmcentire.com. McIntyre is McEntyre. If you put in an I, you won't get there.
Okay. marilynmcentire.com.
.com. And the books are on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Most of them are published by Erdmans. So they're available online, but I'd be happy to hear from people, and it's really fun to especially hear from readers what they're doing once they've read the books.
Marilyn,
this one was really fun to write, and it felt like something I wanted to share, so I hope people enjoy it.
Well, certainly I enjoyed it, and it really opened up a lot of new thinking pathways for me. So I appreciate the work that you've done in the creation of Make a List, How a Simple Practice Can Change Our Lives and Open Our Hearts. Marilyn McIntyre, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is available to you on demand. You can go to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can sign up at iTunes. You can download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. So there are lots of places where you can get a hold of Mind Talk. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk. So send an email to me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a professional of your choosing. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.